33 minutes after 7 in the a.m. All of us have been, no doubt, looking at the Security Council of the United Nations as possibly the only institution that could prevent George W. Bush from going to war in Iraq. Counting noses in that body of 15 national representatives has become sort of a difficult game, because there are so many chances for the United States to threaten people or offer them bribes that none of the votes seem to be absolutely definite, with the exception, of course, of U.S. and Great Britain. Joining us to talk about all of this is Phyllis Bennis. Phyllis is a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. Her most recent book, Before and After U.S. Foreign Policy and the September 11th Crisis. Phyllis, good morning.
Good morning, Philip. Good to be with you.
Hi, Phyllis.
Hey.
Most recently, obviously, Spain and has joined Britain as allies with the United States. We also have Bulgaria clearly in line with the U.S. effort to go to war. But the other members of the Security Council seem to be, as I said, very tentative about what they might do. Give us your sense of what's going on here.
Well, just a couple of days ago, we released a new report from IPF that's called The Coalition of the Coerced, which I think is a pretty good description of what's going on in the Council.
Love that term.
The U.S. is claiming, in fact, with great indignation in response to accusations of pressure and bribes, the U.S. is claiming that every country is free to make up its own mind and that they're only trying to persuade other governments on the basis of the merits of the case. But in fact, what's actually going on is something quite different. What's going on is a huge campaign of bribes and pressures on every country in the Council that has not yet declared itself in support of the U.S. position. The countries that are particularly vulnerable, because as you mentioned, right now there are four votes known in support of the U.S. position: the U.S., the Brits, the Spanish, and the Bulgarians. The French and the Germans are leading the opposition. China and Russia have made clear that they're not interested either. So the key votes, because the U.S., even in the absence of a veto, the U.S. needs 9 positive votes to get this thing through. And right now, they only have 4. The other 6 countries that are facing the most extreme pressure to get their votes are the 3 African countries on the Council, Cameroon, Guinea, and Angola, Mexico and Chile, and Pakistan. It's from within those 6 that the U.S. is desperately eager to get 5 votes. And so the offers are coming, the threats are coming, and it's astonishing the range of tools the U.S. has available in its diplomatic arsenal. For example, if we look at Mexico, the Mexicans have been trying for years now to get the Bush administration to take seriously the need for a new agreement on migration and immigration accords, as well as Fox being under tremendous pressure from Mexican farmers who are being very hard hit by new tariffs being imposed under the conditions of NAFTA. And he, again, is eagerly trying to negotiate some relief.
I think you mean removal of tariffs under NAFTA.
You're right. Sorry. Exactly. And so they're trying to negotiate some kind of relief for Mexico's farmers. Without that relief, Fox may, you know, be defeated in the next election. Similarly, Chile, a socialist government, a post-Pinochet government, a government committed to democracy, wanting to make the UN the centerpiece of international law and international politics. But the Chilean government has spent 9 years negotiating a free trade agreement, which many people oppose, but this government is very committed to it. And they're now finished with the negotiations. All that remains is for Congress to ratify it. That in itself isn't a problem. Congress is way out ahead on this one, and they are planning to ratify it regardless of the opposition of unions and others here in the U.S. But they can't ratify it until the Bush administration brings it to Congress. So there's a tremendous threat on Chile that they will be left out in the cold, that this long-negotiated agreement will simply never be allowed to come into play. With the African countries, it's even more explicit. 2 of the 3 African countries, Guinea and Cameroon, get significant aid from the U.S., and keep in mind how impoverished these countries are. They get aid from the U.S. under something called the Africa Growth and Opportunity Act, which sets various conditions for countries to receive aid. One of the conditions, and it sets it out very explicitly in that law, says that no recipient of aid can do anything that undermines U.S. foreign policy interests. So, in a sense, the U.S. doesn't even have to go to them and say, watch it, you guys, if you don't vote with us, you're going to lose your aid money. It's taken as a given. It leads to a kind of political self-censorship, because they know that at any moment they could, the U.S. could impose those terms and leave those impoverished countries with even less money than they now have available.
I want to follow up on what you said, Phyllis, but we've been joined in the studio by Prosop Chatterjee of Free Speech Radio News, who just recently returned from the northern border of Turkey and Iraq. So, Prosop, welcome.
Thank you.
And tell us your view. I mean, maybe I should just sort of open it widely and say, what have you been thinking after returning here and you've seen some of the machinations in the UN Security Council, et cetera? What are you thinking after visiting there? Are you feeling closer to war than ever, or, you know, feeling good about the delay so far?
It's really hard to tell. And I think the idea that... I mean, I think it's a given with all the troops, all the plans, that war will take place. Although every time we seem to be on the edge of that precipice, you know, something seems to pull us back, whether it's the anti-war rallies, whether it's the government of Turkey, or, you know, whether it's the governments of France and Germany. But even though Phyllis uses the word the coalition of the coerced, I think that's a very apt term. But at the same time, these are people who are also willing to be coerced in many ways, at least in the case of Turkey. I can't really speak in terms.
Tell us what happened with that negotiation with Turkey. It was all about money? What was it about?
It's actually still ongoing. The negotiation is not over, even though Turkey in principle last week said, we will allow, 62,000 U.S. troops to be based on our soil. We will give you permission. Our cabinet gives you permission. It's just, a matter of parliament voting on it, which they were going to do on Thursday. It's been postponed to Saturday. So my sense is they're still haggling.
And it's about money, or what's it about?
Well, yes, it's definitely about money. What the Turkish government would like is more money from the United States. They suffered considerably after the first Gulf War. So they talk about $30 billion in losses in terms of the oil that came across the Iraqi-Turkish border to the port of Umurtalik. And so all of this money that they were gaining from transit fees for the oil, that's gone. A lot of businesses collapsed because nobody wants to invest in the region, etc. So they would like to ensure that doesn't happen. But more importantly than that, I think, is the Kurdish question. And we're not talking simply about the Kurds in northern Iraq. We're also talking the huge population of Kurds in southeastern Turkey, because the Kurdish people basically occupy these five countries in the region, Iran, Syria, or parts of these countries, rather, Iran, Syria, southeastern Turkey, northern Iraq, Armenia. And whereas they've been, subjugated to the brutal policies of Saddam Hussein in Iraq, a similar kind of thing has happened in Turkey, where over the last 10 years, 30,000 plus people have died in the civil war, mostly Kurdish people. And the government there represses them just as much as Saddam Hussein does. Maybe they don't use chemical warfare, but they most certainly go in and kill people. They most certainly go in and, prevent people from speaking their language or any such thing. And whereas there are cracks appearing in this facade, and they're now allowing people to, sing some songs, a lot of songs are banned and that kind of thing, they still want to make sure that this group of the Kurdish community doesn't, declare autonomy or freedom when and if Saddam Hussein falls. So this is the thing, is they want to occupy this area. They have troops in Turkey. They're going to put a lot more in Iraq, and they want to repress. So they want the money and the ability to be able to occupy all of the Kurdish part of northern Iraq and southeastern Turkey.
Phyllis Bennis, going back to your outline of the major players in the Security Council discussions, so the U.S. is pretty much France, Germany, and Russia. You're going to do what you're going to do. We're not going to try to pressure you anymore. We're mad at you. Is that pretty much the position right now?
It's the position right now, but we should not assume that that cannot change. The countries are all under enormous pressure. Last night, the Russians made a very strong statement, even saying that they would consider using their veto. Mm-hmm. France has implied that it would use a veto, but many people think that both those countries, as well as China, would be reluctant, that they're much more likely to abstain rather than actually veto.
Why?
Because despite the fact that these are big, strong countries, powerful countries, important trade and military allies of the United States, the U.S. is still the unchallenged superpower. And all of these governments are reluctant to get on Washington's bad side worse than they have to. The challenge they face is between the pressures of Washington and popular opinion at
in
home,
their own countries,
which
right.
is widespread against this war. In fact, I think in the case of France in particular, what probably began as a more tactical disagreement when Chirac refused to accept the U.S. moves towards war has become a much stronger point of principle from which it will be very, very difficult for Chirac to back down given the strength of French public opposition to the war. So in that context, I think that it has become a much more pervasive, powerful opposition than it would have been. In Germany, it was a little bit different because in Germany, the election of Schroeder's Red-Green coalition, the Social Democrats and the Greens, was based on a strong opposition to the U.S. war. Essentially, the only issue in the election was who's more strongly opposed to a U.S. war in Iraq. And it was on that basis that Schroeder was elected. So he has made very clear that he will not back down on this. But Germany, of course, does not have the veto power. And as of tomorrow, Germany ends its 1 month as president of the Security Council that gave it a slightly higher visibility and turns that position over to Guinea. Guinea, I'm sure, is the last thing they want is to be in this public, very public global limelight right now, faced with the attention of the world on how they are going to vote on this globally crucial question at a time when Guinea is still struggling against enormous economic odds. Its president is dying of kidney failure. I can't imagine that the Guinean diplomats are very pleased about being put in this position as of tomorrow.
Is Syria still on the Security Council?
Syria is still on the council. Syria's opposition is taken as a matter of course. Syria has been very quiet, has not tried to make a major public issue out of the out of its opposition, but it's widely understood that it will not could not vote for a U.S. resolution. Pakistan is the other unknown here. Pakistan, of course, is fundamentally dependent on the United States. Having lifted the sanctions that were imposed on Pakistan in response to its nuclear weapons and its nuclear testing, its very provocative actions in Kashmir. But when the U.S. decided it wanted Pakistan's endorsement of the so-called war on terrorism, the question of Pakistan's willingness to accede to U.S. wishes became a given. The problem for General Musharraf, the military general who took power in a coup in 1999, is that public opinion in Pakistan against this war is probably the strongest in the world, probably even stronger than the 96% opposition in Turkey. So he is faced with a very severe challenge of instability and the possibility of overthrow if he actually endorses this. Right now, an abstention from Pakistan is probably the most likely.
Prasad Chatterjee, I saw a headline on the New York Times website today that seemed to be saying people in Iraq were sort of, in Baghdad specifically, were collectively shrugging about the possibility of war. Was that your sense when you were over there? I know you weren't in Iraq, but I got the sense from talking to you earlier that people were concerned, and it wasn't just like maybe war's going to happen, maybe it isn't.
Actually, interestingly enough, that article did ring very true, because
yeah.
In Turkey, I went there assuming that, you know, people would be getting, you know, out the plastic sheets, and literally we heard reports that people were, you know, rushing to the markets and buying plastic sheets and duct tape and that kind of thing. Well, I'm not sure about duct tape, but definitely plastic sheets. And so we actually went to the markets in Diyarbakir, about 150 miles from the border, and we went to the plastic shops and we asked them if they were selling, you know, excessive quantities of plastic sheets, and they said no. People literally were collectively shrugging. At 10 years ago this time, people were fleeing the city. People came in and burgled their homes, And people were saying this time around, we don't know when it's going to happen. We don't want it to happen. I mean, over 90% of the population is completely opposed. But they don't know what to do, and so they're just staying put. And so there was no mad rush. We went to, you know, the dry goods stores to see if people were stocking up, and they weren't. In the case of Iraq, this article you mentioned in the New York Times actually points out that the Iraqi government has given the people 6 months' worth of rations. And in fact, people are saying, we don't want any more food. I mean, Saddam Hussein's government is trying to ensure that people, there won't be this sort of mad rush in the immediate future if there's war.
So the neighboring countries of Iraq, whether it's Iran or Turkey or Syria or Jordan or Saudi Arabia, is there universal opposition to a war against Iraq, or is there a shrug also?
Well, I did come across a couple of people in Turkey who were interested in the war. One was the War Workers Union, the people who work for the American military. They were in favor. They weren't in favor of the war, but they said they would support a war and their jobs depend on it. But literally everybody we met, every single person, you know, the hundreds of people we met in Turkey were opposed to the war. I wasn't in Jordan or Syria, so I'm not sure. But my understanding is there's definitely, you know, a lot of opposition. Phyllis mentioned Pakistan and the opposition. I don't know if you read this morning, but two people were killed outside the U.S. consulate. They were gunned down. There's an incredible amount of anti-American feeling in the region, and it's growing by the day.
You just heard from Prosop Chatterjee of Free Speech Radio News, who recently returned from the border of Turkey and Iraq, and also joining us on the phone line, Phyllis Bennis, who is a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies and author of the book Before and After U.S. Foreign Policy and the September 11th Crisis. And what was the name of that U.N. book? Calling the Shots, I believe, right, Phyllis? Speaking of that topic, I'm curious, because you have been such a watcher of the UN for many years and know so much about it. It seems to me, not as an expert, that this level of coercion and bullying and bribery and all of this is unprecedented, but maybe this is just par for the course where the U.S. is concerned. So give us a sense of how different a time we are where the UN is concerned than we have been in, say, the last 10 years.
Well, you know, I think both of your scenarios are true. This is par for the course, but it's worse, it's more overt, it's more in your face, and it's far more dangerous. If we look back to the first Gulf War, clearly at that time we saw that there were examples of this kind of blatant bribery and threats and punishments that went into the U.S. trying to get the U.N. to support authorization for the use of force against Iraq. In 1990, the famous story of Yemen, who voted no, and the U.S. diplomat walked over to the Yemeni ambassador and said, "That will be the most expensive no vote you ever cast," in a remark that was picked up on an open mic and broadcast around the world. And 3 days later, the U.S. cut its entire aid budget to Yemen. And people at the U.N. still talk about the Yemen precedent. It still resonates. In my own view, I don't think it was an accident that I think he knew exactly that the mic was open, because I think it was designed as a message for other countries in the world. China was bribed with diplomatic rehabilitation and new development aid. The poor countries on the council were bribed largely with Saudi oil, cheap Saudi oil. So bribery is an old story. What's different this time around, I think, is one, the massive opposition of countries around the world to this war. Keep in mind that in 1990, although many countries disagreed with the need to go to war to reverse it, Iraq had invaded Kuwait, and it was a clear violation of international law. So the opposition wasn't quite as powerful as it is now, where countries and peoples are saying, Iraq hasn't attacked the U.S. What is this about? You know. The other thing that makes it different is the level of public opposition. You know, 2 days after the massive outpouring of demonstrations around the world on February 15th, the New York Times ran a front-page article that began with the extraordinary statement that we have once again two superpowers in the world, the United States and global public opinion.
Wow.
That's an astonishing thing to say, mm-hmm. And I think that has dramatically changed the understanding of what governments are up against when the U.S. tries to get them to cave in to U.S. wishes.
Phyllis, with regard to the French and the Russians, one allegation that's out there is that though public opinion in both countries is totally against war, the politicians in both countries are much more concerned about oil contracts that they've already signed with Saddam Hussein and that would probably be voided if Saddam Hussein is overthrown. And, of course, if France and Russia are not on board with the U.S., once the U.S. conquers Iraq, they very possibly wouldn't get any new contracts out of the region.
Right. Those are very serious concerns. In Russia, it's not only oil contracts for the future, but there's also an $8 billion debt that Iraq owes to Russia from past arms deals and other deals, which they're very concerned about not having written off by a post-Saddam Hussein government, as they like to call it. But I think the other thing that's going on, aside from the dramatic pressure of public opinion in both countries, particularly for France, but for Russia as well, this has a lot to do with the whole question of European expansion and who are going to be the new powers in Europe. When Rumsfeld made his famous remark about old Europe and new Europe, old Europe being irrelevant and has-beens, that being France and Germany,
right,
and new Europe being Bulgaria and Romania and the NATO wannabes of the former Soviet bloc, he actually had his finger on something, which is that these countries, the new NATO members, the new will-be European Union members, if they in fact are ratified in, come to the table far more pro-American, far more willing to accept American dominance as a given, as a positive thing, than the other countries of Europe.
We're going to have to leave it right there, Phyllis, and return to this topic, I'm sure, in the near future.
Good.
We can get that report online, though, right, that you mentioned, the Coalition of the Coerced.
Yep.
I see that it's a little complicated, people, if you got your pen ready. It's www.ips-dc.org, and then it's /coalition.htm. So I guess...
But if you just go to the IPS website, it's the first thing that comes up.
Okay, ips-dc.org.
Right.
Phyllis Bennis, author of Before and After, U.S. Foreign Policy and the September 11th Crisis, and Protop Chatterjee of Free Speech Radio News, airing each weekday at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Now we're